When you go back to and say health is the most important societal pillar, or what if it was, then you begin to think about, okay, what is the role of health on other things? Who are these people also behind Brexit? These are people who somehow are left out of society. I do understand. I'm not saying that I like their argumentation or I approve of their argumentation, but I do understand why it happens. And one of the main components of being left out is lack of access to health and healthcare and adequate social service. So the role of health in order to make this change is actually to move it from being something we do when I'm ill to something we do in order to keep a safe and secure society. So it's a component in society and not an add-on to society. There is also a difference in a European and a US context, where in a US context you would see health almost as a luxury, where here it's a part of human rights.
Hey, welcome back. Today I want to introduce you to an extraordinary person, Bogi Eliasson. Bogi is Director of Health at the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, CIFS. As Director of Health at the Institute, Bogi focuses on the future of health, such as genomics, use of data, digital functions, and their integration with healthcare. He received the HIMSS Future 50 Global Award for his work in 2019, and he initiated the Nordic Health 2030 Initiative, and has a key role in both the Global Future Proofing Health Index and Movement Health 2030. However, our discussion today mostly is focused on Denmark's position as a digital and health innovation leader in Europe. I had become aware that Denmark's integrated welfare system and near complete digitalization of its entire population's health records provides a unique opportunity for digital health and data-driven innovation. In our conversation, we also covered Denmark's strengths in life sciences, significant funding sources that other countries may not have from organizations like Novo Nordisk Foundation. And the conversation further delved into the challenges and strategies related to chronic disease management, and he advocated for a more preventive and holistic approach to health. The broader implications of health as a societal pillar and its interaction with socioeconomic factors and politics, as well as climate change, also made for a somewhat philosophical conversation that I hope will challenge your thinking and, yes, perhaps your curiosity about how innovation happens in Denmark's health system.
What does it feel like to innovate in Denmark? Yes. I think a bit of context is necessary. The Nordic systems, as Denmark, are welfare systems with fairly small populations, so between 5 and 10 millions, with Sweden being the biggest one. But they also have healthcare systems that are tax-paid. So there is a universal access to health, which makes things very different, for instance, from US, but also from most of the world, because there are actually not many countries with that setting. It also means that the majority of health is public in some way. You have some additions of private providers, but then, of course, there's a huge component of private-public partnership in that way. So access to care, in principle, is on a totally different level than you see discussions in most countries. It's more accessible for everybody, but of course, it also means that you probably have a higher average on quality, but you don't have the low and the very high as you would have in other countries. So only access of some very good solutions only for the richest in that way. So it's different. When it then comes to the innovation, there is a lot of support in the system. Denmark specifically has a old business structures on foundations, which is why the Novo Nordisk Foundation is the biggest foundation in the world today, but you have others as well. So they are also providing funding and facilitating innovation in many ways, which you don't really see in the other Nordic countries. So this is clearly where Denmark is ahead in that way. So you had the fund construction, which doesn't exist anymore, but the companies that were established, I think it was before 85 or something like that. At that point, you could have a foundation owning the company, and in that way, you can distribute part of your revenue to society, in, as you also know from the US. And that is a huge difference between Denmark and the other countries. But by coincidence, in Denmark, you also have some pharma companies that have been there for a long time. So Novo is the most famous, but you also have Lundbeck and Leo Pharma, which are of okay size, not among the biggest like Novo is beginning to be now. And that, of course, has had a huge push on the life science part. In Sweden, partly you have also had it because of AstraZeneca, which is not Swedish anymore, but used to be. But that has pushed a specific focus on life science in Denmark, because there was also a need for recruitment, collaboration with the universities for education, to get more of the STEM into schools in different ways. So you should see it in that context, why Denmark has been pushing ahead. Then when it comes to the digital side of it, probably you can push more as a small country on some things.
Just to ground the conversation with a reference point, in 2023, 13% of research dollars granted in Denmark came from the Novo Nordisk Foundation, Big Pharma, for a total of about $1.33 billion US. It's only 0.35% of GDP for Denmark, but still, it's a decent amount of research dollars. Okay, and what else makes Denmark such a hotbed for digital innovation in healthcare?
Denmark, if you now jump over the first parts of it, there was a decision, I don't know if that's 15 years ago, to enforce everybody to have an electronic mailbox. So everything, every information you get from the public system, you actually get electronically. There was a huge pushback in the population, but it was enforced through. And it only takes a couple of months and people realize that this is much easier than getting paper mail. And you can actually find your information, which is a problem for most parts. And once you see it works, the trust in the system and that the system actually takes care of the information comes. Most countries, or have been very difficult in most countries. But it also does that this identifier is a unique identifier that you apply for everything, not just for health. It's it.
To life sciences in the Nordic countries, Boji says that is no surprise that there's a strong push for STEM education, and the presence of a talented workforce doesn't hurt either. So what other drivers make Denmark such a digital-friendly ecosystem?
In your passport, it's on your driver license. When you buy your car, you put in your number so you can be identified. It's in your bank account. It's your tax record. It's one identity. Of course, in order to push this forward, there needs to be some trust in the public sector. So, of course, there is a lot of governance behind that. You end up in a situation where there is some abuse at some times, but it's much less than what you would expect. And there seems to be an acceptance in the population that this is the way it is working. And it does facilitate a lot of more easy ways of working. So, for instance, if you want to look at different correlations, you can match up with the Danish statistics and probably with some health data that you have in some repositories, and you can try to see age, gender, education, working history, all of these things on a level which you now can apply with different kinds of AI and taking different information from different sources in different ways, but which has been possible in a Danish setting for decades because you could look in different ways. For instance, to try to look at patterns on when you get disease A, what is the likelihood of you getting disease B in a certain time? And you can look at, I don't know, 1,000 patients and you begin to see patterns in different ways. Not explaining the biological functions, but just patterns. So that is one part of it. And I do think that when it comes to health, there was quite early a huge maturity in thinking, okay, how do you do this? In reality, like in all other countries, digital health records started as local innovation projects. You got some money from the local region or municipality and maybe some local businesses, and you started your own health records in some way. Not health records as we know them today, but digital health as the first generation. In Denmark, you were very early to establish something called Medcom, which is a collaboration between the municipalities, region, and the health ministry and the other players, where you constantly work on standards and to align and how to help each other. And you find pockets of innovation that you then adapt to being national solutions in that way. I do think that is not a very known, but probably one of the most important components why it started early to be very structured in the way forward. So you could say when you go to conferences, interoperability is always a topic and it's a never ending story because you always need to adapt. But here you started very early in trying to get that to work. Not saying that it's perfect, not saying that there's not much more to do, but just saying that it has moved quite early on that path.
Okay, so Denmark is so far ahead digitally because of some decisions made almost 50 years ago with early efforts at building digital records and the necessary centralized data storage systems. Pretty cool. It's important here to remember that Denmark is a small country, about 6 million people, or the population of, say, Missouri or Colorado or even Maryland. Health systems of that size in the United States include Kaiser Permanente, Advent Health, and even the Cleveland Clinic. Now, both Kaiser and the Clinic had early versions of DOS-based medical records at this time. Okay, very interesting. Next, I asked if he could point out how having all this data at their fingertips had been used to manage the population and its health.
Yes, so you could say it has not been applied enough. That's clear. But of course, when you compare with other countries, you would always look at the possibilities that are not used. Then you might be ahead of other countries, but you're still seeing the gaps that you could close. For instance, in COPD, there was a project started, and I think it's already 10 years ago. So the challenge is that the basic infrastructure to move care to home, because COPD is something where you need a constant monitoring, is very heavy for the patient. Half of the time that they end up in hospital, at least normally, is not necessary. It could have been mitigated in other ways, which is both much better for the patient, but also for the system in general. So you set up a general infrastructure for the municipalities, the regions who own the health budget. There are five regions in Denmark that also own the hospitals and the health ministry, because they knew that if you're not making a common infrastructure, only the biggest municipalities would start doing this. The smaller ones would not do it, and everybody would do it in their own way. So you would not be able to combine and risk share in that way. And that is now working fairly well, where you can reduce the unnecessary access to especially emergency. So that's one example where this is very helpful. So here, I don't know if you are reducing the disease burden per se, but you're reducing the unnecessary pain on the patients and on the system with this specific disease burden. Then when it comes to diabetes, so you have the Steno centers, which are in each region, that are working a lot on also the secondary prevention of diabetes, also a bit about the primary prevention, and especially the one in Aarhus, the second city where I also live in Denmark. They are working very hard on how do you, with apps and real-time data, how can you really monitor if everybody is on the stage that should be on? So they have an aspiration about keeping the patient away from the hospital. So there is a national portal translated called health.dk. And there you have access to all of your data, your own data, and you also get all the answers, and that then was also correlated or connected to the COVID answers. So everything came in there. That is also an organization just like Medcom that the municipalities, the regions, and the health system or health ministry own. And it has two faces. So one of them is to you as a person, and the other one is to the professionals. It's not the same, but it's the same data, right? But they project the data. They don't sit on the data in that way. But as a individual person, I have access to my own health records. I can book my time at the hospital, GPs, all of these things, and follow those. But there is also a service on health providers that are approved in the system. So you can go in. So if I want physiotherapy, you can go in and see, okay, who is approved for reimbursement? Who is not? Psychologists, all of these things. So you have like a filtered information, what's on that page has been curated. Also information about diseases in different ways. So now, yes, I mean, in old days, but now there are two systems applied in Denmark. Epic is in two regions, I think, and Systematic, a Danish, is in the others. But of course, there are interoperability requirements. So between, so you can, as a patient, you can go in between, but as this, there is still much to come after in this world in order to make it work seamless.
In Denmark, at least two regions are on Epic, and a third is on a domestic program with full data transparency and interoperability between them. So there is a robust infrastructure in Denmark that could support digital innovation, even if the country is small, but the data set is complete and deep, and much can be learned from and built on it. It is also publicly accessible should you want to do research. Next, I wanted to get back into innovation and also how funding is distributed and how innovation is supported in Denmark.
So there are several things. So one thing are these philanthropic funds that I mentioned in the beginning, and they all have their own processes on how to do things. Then you have, for instance, the Public Innovation Fund that has some topic areas. A part of that is health as well. Then you have some clusters, which might be public-private mix in it. Most of them, the public ones, they have been aligned into one structure now called Danish Life Science Cluster. So because there were too many around. Yes, there is a focus there. Like in most countries, there is a challenge generally in Europe that there is more money spent on the first phase here than in the US. But then the US companies are very smart on buying it when it's mature and and get it capitalized from the US on it. And that challenge is definitely also there in Denmark. So it's easier, not easy, but it's easier to get money to the first step of innovation. And then it's very hard to go from there, what normally is called the death valley of innovation. That is really a challenge. If I take another example also, because this is something where we are involved, clinical trials, when you have pharma companies, it becomes interesting. And when you have as much data as you have in Denmark, it also becomes interesting. But Denmark is also in the corner of the world where things are expensive. So 10 years ago, Denmark had lost much of the edge of attracting clinical trials. And then the partners sat together and created something called Trial Nation. And then you have all the relevant public partners or the ones that need to give some kind of approval or authorization, and also the ones who then are applying. So it's like a virtual organization in that way. But they also spend quite a lot of time on, I think every quarter there are meetings where you take up all of these things that could be better. So you're trying to improve the seamless process. But in that, for instance, if you as a coming PI or a company, or if you want to do some kind of a trial on a new pharma product or medtech, whatever it is, you can contact them and they help you with everything. So where do you need to ask for licenses? Which clinic in which hospital actually has the expertise to work with this? Where do you have people who have worked with this before? Do you have people who have been through clinical best practice education so they are actually ready to run those things? So all of these things that you in most countries would need to do by yourself is then the service organ is doing. Because you want to attract clinical trials, not just because you have a big pharma sector in Denmark and medtech per se, but also because this is a part of attracting knowledge, attracting investment, but you also improve health systems quality with being hands-on with the newest technology and newest opportunities in it. And you give access to the newest kind of treatment to your patients. So that's one example on how it has been approached in a practical way.
It's so interesting that the government had to step in to optimize the experience for pharma and other companies to run trials in Denmark and keep the research dollars flowing. But what about robotics? I'd heard that Denmark was quite ahead in the way it promoted robotic applications in healthcare. Indeed, I think they have centralized all robotics training to one facility in the country. So all the surgeons who want to maybe pick up a robot for their hospital have the opportunity to go to a center where they have all the robots and train on all of them.
There has been quite some focus on robotics, and there is a big robotics cluster in Odense, so the system, the city of Hans Christian Andersen. And there is still some focus on it. I cannot answer to you if this is a gold mine for Denmark or not. That, I think, still remains to be seen. And robotics is a little bit like what we see in AI at the moment. There's a lot of expectations, but probably if you're not in a small niche area, this is a scaling game in certain ways. But that said, everything we will work with going forward will have a component of automation and AI, different kinds of combining biology with smart materials, with data structures and knowledge in different ways. So doing those kinds of combinations in the real settings is where the Nordic countries are probably a good fit. So one of my main projects is what we call Nordic Health 2030. Mm-hmm. And the idea there started somewhere around 2017-18. We were doing a big scenario process on with Danish health leaders, so 35 public, private, everything, on looking, okay, what are the options, or what are four main possible scenarios for 2030? And from there, try to figure out, okay, what is it we can steer and try to prioritize in that way. One of the conclusions was that given the technology that's coming, so being genomics, being data, using knowledge in different ways, country the size of Denmark cannot work alone. It needs to be bridged. And here, the conclusion was that since the Nordics are fairly on a similar level and structured in a fairly similar way, a Nordic way to look at this would be preferable. So we started digging into that. My own part to push this was also that the society was moving quite fast from being a geographical-based analog to being a non-geographical-based digital. And that does something with the social contract. So where is your solidarity? How do you build those things together? So my drive in this was as much to look at what does a risk-sharing, solidarity-based social contract look like when half of your life is analog and half of your life is digital.
So this is an interesting question, right? What happens to a society when its geographic boundaries no longer define it? When its population spends, say, half their waking and working hours interfacing digitally and potentially with people in other geographic regions outside the boundaries of the country? Where is their allegiance? Where do they expect to get their care? Interesting questions.
So for instance, if you are in a cancer situation with the most modern technology, you would not just look at data from your own hospital. You would compare with the mutations in the cancer from different countries, likely in order to find the best treatment. And it goes, you as a person, for instance, I'm a huge football soccer fan, so I spend a lot of time looking at football from Barcelona and Liverpool, which has nothing to do where I live. So when it comes to football, my heart is not in Denmark or the Faroes where I'm from. It's actually in Barcelona and Liverpool and the groups around that. And this is where I think we need to see health as well. And my way of looking at health, and this is where the Nordic Health comes in, is asking the question, what happens if you see health as the most important societal pillar? So not just to provide care when you're ill, but actually to construct it so it's a value creator, so you get a sustainable society in different ways. And here, the hospital has a role, but so does education, so does access to clean water, to working conditions, and all of these things. So it's very important that we see health as something that's with you the whole life, and not something we do when everything has gone wrong, as we do today.
Another interesting point Bogi raises is the idea that health and healthcare are a societal pillar, a necessary requirement for society to function, and should be treated as necessary and not as a nice-to-have benefit for those who can afford it. Interesting perspective.
And in this part, when we did the first round of Nordic Health in 2019, we looked at the data in the Nordics. So how does it look? Our disease burden is growing, so we reduce the communicable diseases and accidents, but the lifestyle diseases, so chronic diseases, are exploding. And then if you look at then, with the current model that we are working with workforce and money, is this sustainable? No. Is there a big likelihood that this will break down very soon? Yes. What is the discussion we see in all of the Northern European countries? It is, we don't have workforce, so we just import workforce from somewhere else. But you're already reaching a point where 25% of your workforce will do health and social care. Is that sustainable? No. And one example that I often use is that, and this is because the statistics from the US actually is quite good. If you look at the US data on fatalities in motor accidents over the last 120 years per driven mile, it has been reduced by 95%. Because better cars, better safety, better roads, better education of drivers, all of these things. In health, we have just said that, oh, we will get more disease. So that's why we need to put more money and more people and more technology into the disease solution. but we are still acting as if we were 100 years ago, where we had accidents and communicable diseases. So people screaming, coming into the hospital, deal fast or else they die. Now 85% of the disease burden is on non-communicable diseases, where you actually need to act before anybody knows they're ill, almost, or very early at that stage. So the question we are working on here is saying, how can you reduce this avoidable disease burden, which we estimate to be 30%? So the health system's breakdown is actually caused because we don't time the use of our technology. We still use it very late. The impact of what we do is minimal compared to if we spend the same energy as early as possible. So precise diagnostic and precise intervention as early as possible, or timely intervention as early as possible.
I find that reframing some of the questions we're otherwise familiar with is really helpful, and Bogey is a master at this. In the section we just heard, he points out that the impact of neglecting preventive care and offering treatment only once the patient has a disease is far more expensive and complicated than avoiding the problem in the first place, and this is not news. But it is interesting that reducing disease burden becomes a goal in a prepaid system. This thinking only holds water in a single-payer system like Denmark, where disease is not a source of revenue. In a fee-for-service system like the United States, the incentives are simply not well aligned. Years ago, I'll give you an example, kind of frightening situation, but a friend of mine at a major teaching institution ran a high-risk pregnancy program that was incredibly successful, so much so that the newly built NICU, neonatal intensive care unit, was pretty much empty. As a result, he was nearly fired. The NICU was a massive revenue generator for the hospital. Crazy. So in Denmark, how does the government align incentives with outcomes, or how does that work in the Nordics in general?
My question here to decision maker is always, so what is your aspiration? Is it the best possible health system, or is it the healthiest population? And of course, the reality is somewhere in between those two, but you would need to choose what is your main driver on this part. If we look at the strain we see on health systems today, there is no way we are able to finance the way we are working, and we don't even get the hands that we need. For instance, in Germany, where we sit now, I think the number is that 30% of the healthcare professionals will retire over the next 10 years. The recruitment is immensely difficult, so you don't get those people in. So no matter what you believe, the change needs to come because you can't sustain the current way of thinking. My opinion is that we shouldn't, but even if you would like to, you can't. And this then came out to our conclusion of the work, which we call 5-5 or 50-50. Given that the Nordic countries spend around 10% of GDP on health or direct sick care, so treatment, the conclusion, and this is not my conclusion, the conclusion from the expert group was that we needed to aspire that by 2030, half of that budget should be much more preventative. So primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention, not just the health promotion. How do you get in and work much more deliberate, for instance, with secondary prevention on once you have the first chronic disease, how do you optimize, if that's the right word, to reduce disease progress as much as possible and delay the onset of additional chronic diseases as much as possible. So the benchmark is not how much treatment can I give, but how much disease can I reduce, disease burden can I reduce. A huge part of it would be to change what we pay for, which I think will change a part of that dynamic. So the reimbursement dynamics, because today you pay for activity on a identified disease conclusion. You are not paying for well-being. So that's one thing. What you are mentioning, I fully agree. The biggest challenge is that a person who goes to a doctor, they ask for pills or knives. They're not asking for change in behavior. And they get annoyed if they get by a dog and walk, for instance, which often would be the better solution. I fully agree. Health literacy is probably a change management assignment that we need to put into this if we want to go forward. But for instance, if we see the epidemic of mental challenges that we're seeing with the younger generation now, if we are just going to go in with the same mindset and just put drugs into these people, at a level that we have treated the cardiovascular disease and diabetes, we're going to have huge challenges in 20, 30 years. It's a non-acceptable progress. So sometimes I think you would need to say, okay, what if we just go forward like this for 30, 40 years? Is that a utopia or is it a total dystopia? In my world, it's a total dystopia, but it's also catastrophic because it will break down the systems. So one thing is to go in and really push this question, what happens if health is the most important societal pillar? I work quite a lot in Latin America. They cannot afford to make the super hospitals, luckily. So this is about high tech and right tech at primary care. So I do have a naive belief. Maybe it's more a hope than a belief. And also because you have plus 500 million people using Spanish for health, that you, with large scale digital solutions, actually can work on a much earlier stage with health in these populations. They have a huge need and they can't pay the way we are paying. So the solutions will be different. Then if you ask me, do I think these changes will come in the richest part of the world? No, I don't. I really do not think so. So that's a part of the answer to your question. The second part is that we are trying to set up pilots with focusing on what we label as the secondary prevention. So the first, chronic disease, how can you work with a person so they get a better quality of life, but it's also cheaper for the system? This is probably something where you can show an effect in 1 to 2 years, while when you do primary prevention, it's 3 decades. And I agree with you, that's immensely difficult. So our focus is, can we prove this with the secondary prevention? What needs to come in, and here comes what really threw me off a couple of years ago. So I was trying to look at the economics on health in different ways. And then I got this brilliant self idea, which is, of course, many have thought before. What is the cost of inaction in health? And as a political scientist and worked in the administration and with companies and all of these things, my immediate thought was, okay, health is around 10 to 15% of the budget in most countries, is 10% on average for the world. It's a huge amount of the money. So there must be a million different cost of inaction studies. So how do I do criteria for what I look at? So I went looking. How many did I find? There is not a single cost of inaction study on health economics. There are partly on some educations, on some very narrow things in health, but really looking at what is the cost of inaction in continuing as we do compared to if we applied technology as we know we could.
So again, another interesting reframing of the question on return on investment. So generally, we look at the cost of an action and its impact on some outcome, but we seldom talk about the cost of inaction on that same outcome. What did it cost to not treat a population with diabetes? It's a great question, though perhaps a difficult one to answer, and still a useful reframing when people ask what the cost is of digital transformation or digital innovation. Often I will ask, what's the cost of not? I would argue that in some cases, it basically means you simply will not be either cost-effective or viable in a decade's time.
And that to me was like, not only are we not doing it, we are not even thinking about doing it in that way. So when you ask about missing bricks or stepping stones, that is probably the biggest one. Because convincing, and as you said, to go up on stage and talk about this is easy. To convince health ministry is also fairly easy. To convince the finance ministry is not easy. And there you would need those kinds of argumentations. And if you want to do anything, you have to have the finance ministry in. That's a given, often underestimated. That is one of the way we are trying to approach this. And then the other thing is, when you go back to and say, health is the most important societal pillar, or what if it was, then you begin to think about, okay, what is the role of health on other things? So for instance, sitting in Germany, there's a huge challenge with the rising right wing, which you also see in Netherlands, and Belgium, partly in the Nordics as well. Okay, and then you say, something is wrong with our way to debate or our educational system. But if you really go down and look at who are these people also behind Brexit, these are people who somehow are left out of society. I do understand. I'm not saying that I like their argumentation or I approve of their argumentation, but I do understand why it happens. And one of the main components of being left out is lack of access to health and healthcare and adequate social service. So starting the life. So the role of health in order to make this change is actually to move it from being something we do when I'm ill to something we do in order to keep a safe and secure society. So it's a component in society and not an add-on to society. There is also a difference in a European and a US context, where in a US context you would see health almost as a luxury, where here it's a part of human rights in that part.
So linking social unrest to the lack of basic health services is actually fair. History is rife with governments that fell because they could not provide food or safety to their population. And Bodhi suggests that not providing healthcare is also to break the social contract, just like not providing food or safety. And the populations can turn on their governments when that doesn't happen. And conversely, providing adequate healthcare can create a pillar for a stable society. What else?
The next connection here is climate change. So climate change is often articulated as one of the biggest health risks that we have, because and here we get communicable diseases in again, but also respiratory diseases and all of this getting in. I turn it around and say, how can we ask for climate change, which is in reality is make the many change a bit? And how are you going to ask the broad world, where 60, 70% struggle every day, to consider their priority in concern of the climate if their basics are not okay? So the basic salary, the access to health, the access to a healthy life. So actually we need to work much more broadly, and this is also why I work so much in Latin America, to make sure that the basic for the majority is much better, so they actually can focus on climate change. So here health is not, or the ill health is not necessarily the first priority as a consequence of climate change, but actually the good health in order to have people working with improving the climate. So these are different roles as I see for health. But of course, I come from a political science background, so I think more about what are the drivers for health in society than just looking at the health system itself. So for instance, one of the more directly inside life science and health that we are focusing a lot on is, how does this fourth industrial revolution look like? So I work quite a lot with genomics, but we are getting what I call the new biology. So different, not just the, how can I say, more static genome by itself, but also the more real-time expressions in different ways with the multi-omics that we are seeing. And now we are seeing an explosion in image technologies in different ways, both handheld and bigger inside hospitals. And because of the computing power and the bandwidth, you can work in many different ways with it. And smart materials, nanotechnologies coming in. So what we are trying to put forward and work with here is, how do you enable to work, which is on each piece very reductionistic, but combined very holistic? So this is a leadership gap that we have. I can just ask you, how many people do they can think super specialized and holistic at the same time? There are very few. There is no education in this. It doesn't exist. So one of the things that we are promising with the technology is that this will help on this and this. But if we don't get the leadership first and then further down in the system on how to work with this, we will never reap the benefits on it. So that's another part that we are focusing a lot on, is not just what it is, how do we make it work? And that is the next step we are doing with the Nordic Health now, is really to go in with work streams and say, okay, we know this is the way we want to work, or this is the headings that we have. How do we do it piece by piece? Those are some of the things. And now we have a big bet on using the respiratory area as examples on the secondary prevention. COPD is beginning to be the biggest challenge in many countries. It's a very expensive challenge, but it's also it's a challenge that has a huge weight on social determinants. It's mostly the poorer part of the population that gets it. Of course, it's much based on smoking, but it is 100% avoidable. So the third biggest cause of disease and disease burden in many of the Western countries is 100% avoidable. This is where we are trying to work out some of these ideas on how do we go forward with this.
The last thing I wanted to ask about was what he thought might be the biggest opportunity in the midterm, say the next decade, an area where technology could provide a digital first country like Denmark a significant advantage, or something they could explore.
So one of the main projects we are doing in Denmark with support is It's called phase five. It's a way of thinking the future of clinical trials, decentralized and digitized. And there are universities, pharma companies, hospitals, everything is involved. And it has funding from the Danish Innovation Fund. So if I came to you 15 years ago, so I had my first iPhone, I think it's 15 years ago, the iPhone 3. I was very annoyed with it because it took me 2 weeks to figure out how to hit these buttons on writing and stuff. Anyway, it could some things, but it was not very useful compared to what we do with a smartphone today. But if you came to me at that point and you said to me, in 15 years, you would happily pay $1,000 for a device like this, even more maybe, and you would know that probably 50 companies are stealing data from you, and you would go, but the value is so big that it's okay. I don't really want to discuss it. You would probably say, no way. I would have said, no way. And still everybody accepts it. So this is what I see will happen to the home inside the next 5 to 10 years. Because we are already beginning to have programs that can see your face, your ways of walking, if you're at risk of falling, if you took your medication or not, if you are in pain or not. So it's not the subjective, you put the data in, but it's actually the objective observing, and then a little bit, you put the data in. As soon as we can optimize enough validated data, the value of having these things at home for people who are at risk or at a certain age or have some disease is immense. And it will really revolutionize. And this is what we are trying to do as one of the thought experiments with phase five is not saying everything starts at the doctor office and whatever can be at the doctor should be there. It's disrespectful and undignified to the patient because often they have to spend a day on traveling to talk with a nurse for 5 minutes instead of that you turn it around and say, what can actually be at home at the patient? And when you can't do more things at home, you go to the GP or the local health center. And when you can't do more there, you go to the hospital. And this is one of the, which I didn't mention, which is my main driver in everything I do, put dignity at the center. So what happens? So one of my questions, and this annoys some people and I live with it. When you did the COVID lockdown, if dignity was one of the criteria you needed to tick off, would you have locked down in elderly and weak people for 2 years so they couldn't see their next of kin or the families or all of these things? No, you wouldn't. Would it have a different consequence on some things? Yes, it would. And I think this is the biggest challenge also for the change that you asked for. How do we change from a extreme care system to maybe not an extreme, but much more, how can I say, well-being system, is to really articulate dignity. And dignity is different than ethics. Ethics is something that you set up in a theoretical frame and often becomes very political. Dignity, we understand as something that is fair. How do you keep the self-esteem and the self-determination of people while you help them in different ways and give them tools?
I found speaking with Bogi an exceptional exercise in thought experimentation and reframing of problems. I particularly liked the idea of healthcare as a social pillar that governments can ignore at their peril. The idea that climate change is linked to healthcare, also as a powerful driver of socioeconomic change, and that current diseases are largely preventable, and that technology in the home may be one of the solutions to righting the healthcare ship going forward, particularly with chronic diseases. So thank you for listening. I look forward to our next episode with you. For now, take care. Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I'll reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.